tornado.
Good evening.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Derivative Living, our second keynote event of Transmediale 2018. My name is Daphne Dragon and I'm the conference curator. This year, as you have heard and read, our title is Face Value, and with it we wish to address the crisis of politics, values and meanings in today's economized and polarized world. What happens, we want to ask, when an economic term, usually associated with money, real estate, and debt, comes to invoke the politics of life itself? How do we respond to the fact that people are valued or devalued based on the constructions of class, race, and gender? How do today's media's platforms and technological systems affect, facilitate, and accelerate processes of value extraction with the categorization and filterings? The politics and the economy of face value that prevail today are intertwined and confirmed what political scientist and black studies theorist Cedric Robison had stressed, that capitalism is based on the exploitation of economic, geographical, and racial differences. What we aim to do in this year's conference is to revisit this relation between capitalism and racism and to locate, expose, and discuss its new formations, which are directly related to financialization and computation. For this reason, we are very honored to have with us tonight Jonathan Beller, whose profound work on the attentional capital, and more specifically on computational racial capitalism, sheds light on this specific topic. The keynote tonight was to be moderated by Professor David Berry, who very unfortunately canceled due to a serious family issue just a few hours ago. So the keynote will be introduced and moderated by Matteo Pasquinelli, to whom we are very thankful that he accepted our invite at such a short notice. I'd like to close here and only mention that we thank the Bundeszentrale für politische Bildung for their support to this year's conference. Thank you very much. You have to excuse me. It's due to the stress that the cancellation caused. I forgot to introduce Matteo properly. So Matteo Pasquinelli is a professor in media philosophy at the University of Arts and Design. He edited the anthology Alice of Your Mind, Augmented Intelligence and Its Traumas, among other books. His research focuses on the intersection of cognitive science, knowledge economy, and machine intelligence. For Verso Books, he's preparing a monograph provisionally titled The Eye of the Master, Capitalist Computation Cognition. Matteo, excuse me. Thanks a lot.
Good evening, dear participants of the festival. For me, it's an honor to be last minute emergency replacement for David Baird that couldn't be here. It's not a big issue. I'm very honored to introduce John Bella, that is a friend, a comrade, and a former colleague also. And John is a professor of humanities and media studies and critical visual studies at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. He works on theorizing the visual turn and the attention economy, the history of cinema and the screen image. His work has been very influential, and his thinking provides important insight for how we begin to draw what we might call cognitive maps of computational capital. He has published a number of important books, like this one that just came out, The Message is Murder, Substrates of Computational Capital, for Pluto Press. Then a book from 2006, that's the way I also had the opportunity to meet his work, The Cinematic Mode of Production, Attention Economy and the Society of the Spectacle. That for me was an important book because one of the few books that was able to deal with cinema studies and political economy on the same ground. I guess it's still a unique book. And then I would like to remember Acquiring Eyes, Philippine Visuality, Nationalist Struggle, and the World Media System from 2008. He's also had a special issue of The Scholar and Feminist Online, titled Feminist Media Theory, and also serves on the editorial collective of the journal Social Text. Tonight, John is going to talk to us about platform communism, which he described as a program for derivative living against the regime of informatic consumption. I warn you, it will be pretty tough. This is a subject that is very close to the theme of the Transmediale, of the CS edition. And I think it will be provide us with new concepts, new ideas, and tools for a response to informatic labor and computational racial capitalism. And John, by linking a number of formations from race to gender and violence to the emergence of a computational capital, I guess it speaks to the timely issue of this festival. And I would just say that for me, John is a unique scholar because he's one of the few figures that is able to deal with media theory, political economy, and colonial studies at the same time. I guess also in Europe, figures like him are pretty rare. So please welcome with me John to the podium.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you. I just want to thank Daphne and the Transmediale organizers for putting together an amazing event from across the Atlantic. We admire Transmediale, and we have nothing like it. I was talking to Lisa Nakamura earlier, and the fact that there are so many people here doing media theory and critical media studies is really kind of amazing and inspiring. Also, I just wanted to mention, and I don't want to dwell on it, but David's family emergency, I just wish we'd all send him good energy right now for a minute. And I want to thank Matteo for the kind introduction. It's really such a pleasure to see him and to be here among all of you to have this conversation, which I think is urgent. Let me switch over to my slides. Oh, they're up, great. The title of my talk, the full title, is Beyond Derivative Living, It's Platform Communism, a Program for Derivative Living Against Regimes of Informatic Subsumption. I'm really grateful that Francois Vergès last night spoke and put colonialism, racial capitalism, and environmental racism at the center, or proposed that it might be at the center of media theory. So it's not media and racial capitalism, but media as racial capitalism that we might want to start to think seriously about. And my talk pursues that. I'm going to just briefly show the structure of my talk. Hold on, if I can. Somehow I think this is not functioning. Okay. If someone can come help me with the slide, I'd really appreciate that, but I'll just keep going. The structure of my talk is going to deal with kind of four sections. The first is called Toxic Media. The second is Toxic Finance. Thank you. The third is Toxic Information. And the fourth will be Programmable Economies. And I'm going to do something really uncharacteristic for myself, at least, which is try to say something positive tonight. but not until the end. You're going to have to wait for it. But hopefully it's worth the wait. I think in some ways we've all been waiting for a long time to imagine some kind of positive, non-apocalyptic transformation. And it may be... Maybe we can just sniff it out or intuit a little bit. I think some of us feel it, and that's also the reason why we keep showing up at events like this. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Slides. Yeah. So I just went through that. My slides here are kind of an index cards for what I'm saying. As Matteo warned you, it's a little bit dense. I'll try to be convivial about it all and explain things and keep it conversational. But if it gets a little bit rough, just look at the slides, and that's what I'm actually saying. Okay. So media structure, media infrastructure, both functions as, and indeed is, fixed capital. And this is one of the themes of The Message is Murder, which I suppose you could reduce to a sentence and suggest that all communications infrastructure depend upon racial capitalism and the reproduction of global hierarchy. That's a rather blunt thesis, and I promise you it's a little bit more subtle in the text, but let me just leave it at that for the moment and work out some other details here. Communications infrastructure, increasingly computational, is fundamentally an extractive technology that valorizes capital, irrespective of the message sent. Probably we know this dequalification, and to use a financial term, liquidation of our meaning, first, not by analysis, but phenomenologically, through the objection, depression, psychosis, spectacular violence, and other mental illnesses everywhere present, pre-sent, or from the seeming insolubility of seemingly clear-cut problems like climate injustice and massive global immiseration, or again, from the dissolution of all that was solid, records, photographs, sensibilities and relationships, landscapes, into computational media, social or antisocial. Subjects collapse, bodies are screened, spaces are virtualized, objects are distributed, reality hyphenates with television, feelings are memed, and synthetic finance replaces the real economy, the old order of facts and reality that now appears only in quotation marks. Life is decoded, re-encoded, cut up by algorithms, and subject to financialization at all levels. In the everyday failure of our expressive power to constitute ourselves as subjects or even as nodes of viable political agency, and in our awareness that expression is functionalized by algorithmic forms of capture beyond our ken, we approach the deeper meaning of what was implied by Claude Shannon's mathematical theory of communication, when its stated prerequisite was that the theory had to be content indifferent. This functionalization of expression, its transposition to number, regardless of its medium of emergence or what it says, can retrospectively be understood as the fatal capture of expression by capital, what we, at times quite naively, call digitization. Here we approach the deeper significance of digitization. Digitization as simultaneously informationalization, computerization, and financialization has implications for visual and discursive production at every level of the socius. Capital, as always already a computer, embarked upon a centuries-long project of digitization as a condition of its ever-expansive emergence. The spreading of commodification of life inaugurated a thoroughgoing, planet-wide digitization that everywhere turned quality into quantity in a colonial reformatting of ontology and metaphysics, such that today, nearly everything, if not everything legible, is prepositioned and thus configured in some relation to capitalist perception. The subsumption of prior forms of communication by digitality thus raises the question of incommunicability, whether or not it's possible, for us at least, to apprehend or to express anything that does not valorize capital. Not only does such a conundrum deepen the stakes in the analysis of what I originally called the attention economy, and now think of as informatic labor, but the full functionalization of expression as an instrument of perception and thus of production implies that what we call technology has placed thought, consciousness, and utterance under siege as well, since today, no one anywhere can escape being in some recursive relation to the world media system. The toxic fallout from the operations of that system's global organization of social cooperation is globally distributed in atmospheres, oceans, and geologic layers at multiple scales down to the level of the atom. And as human or inhuman debris, it is on streets, in villages, on coastlines, in psyches, fish stomachs, and cell membranes everywhere. So, toxic finance. This global condition, resultant from the financialization of thought and expression, that legitimates, seems to necessitate, and is indeed one with a global mode of production, brings us from media to finance. The toxicity of capitalism ranges from Monsanto to advertising, from colonialism and the Middle Passage to imperialist wars, contemporary migration, the dispossession of billions, food and environmental racism. We know that capitalism has accomplished, justified, and benefited from a level of violence that is beyond conception. It is axiomatic that its value system is fundamentally dependent upon a theft of life, the poisoning of that colonial externality known as the environment, a place that also has included and continues to include people, discounted humans. We also know, thanks in large part to the work of Cedric Robinson on the Black radical tradition and Black Marxism, that aforesaid capitalism is inexorably racial capitalism. Quote, "The creation of the Negro was obviously at the cost of immense expenditures of intellectual and psychic energies. The exercise was obligatory. It was an effort commensurate with the importance of Black labor power, that the importance Black labor power possessed for the world economy," unquote. Racialization and the universal so-called value form are not separate phenomena. Value is not constituted simply from deracinated labor, dissymmetrically exchanged for the wage, but from racialized labor, historically devalued colonial populations, and slavery. Such an encoding of bodies as Black, as colonial, as ethnic, as female, already suggests that media infrastructure, broadly understood, has not only been captured by the financial system, but that what we think of as media are an extension of the financial system. The world media system is a higher phase of capitalism, one composed by converting the myriad energies for social cooperation and mass self-consciousness into technologies of leveraged value extraction. Computational racial capitalism has turned the means of expression into a means of production and reproduction of hierarchical society. The movement of financialization into media of expression, the financialization of expressivity, along with a racializing and gender differentiating grid of intelligibility that functions under the cloak of everyday understandings of digital culture, is an intensification of the affective power of capital and a deployment, harnessing, and development of the semiotics of the value form. This thoroughgoing assault on cultural qualities by economic quantity is an advanced stage of what Adorno and Horkheimer meant by the culture industry. However, it is not simply that mediation and therefore intelligibility itself has become functionalized, but that mediation and intelligibility have themselves become means of further financialization and the subsumption of formerly extra economic domains. Expression, for example. Media forms are deterritorialized factories in which spectators and now content providers work, utilizing their effective attentional and neuronal metabolic capacities. The convergence of media formations with computation, such that nearly all media today are effectively computational media, is also a deeper and more granular convergence with the financial calculus and an ever more precise mobilization of the machines and metrics of capture. This condition, which I call computational capital, means that almost all social activity is ultimately wagered in relation to an ambient calculus of value that most, if not all, planetary denizens are forced to game from their statistically overdetermined locales. Water. Therefore, the phrase that Jennifer Morgan attributes to Sadia Hartman, the brutal calculus of self-betrayal, used when describing a slave coffle forced to sing, where the performance commanded by the masters and exchanged for survival was song, becomes, to varying degrees, the general rule for expression in computational racial capitalism. Our expression is an endeavor to free ourselves, wagered against a calculus of extraction. It is, to use a term from finance, a hedge. I am by no means conflating the general condition of utterance with the condition of chattel slavery, but rather saying that this brutal calculus of self-betrayal is indeed imposed by the totalizing perspective of the world media system in relationship to the species, in which every signal is optimized for profit-taking. Expression has become a hedge, a wager, a playing of the spread opened by the volatility of the social. It has become a derivative. The consequence of, and the conditions for, the functioning of a system the media system, a financial system, an informatic system, a computational system, and their co-development. Let me read that again. The consequences of and the conditions for the functioning of a system that imposes derivative living are, as currently configured, the 2 billion plus living on less than $2 per day, the currently enslaved, those forced into reparations seeking migration, those suffering famine, climate dissolution, genocide, and so on, as the material underside of the chaos management undertaken by the military-industrial complex, financial markets, the world media system, and fractal fascism. To whom the brunt of the violence is delivered is determined algorithmically, stochastically, and in accord with the calculus of social difference grafted to historical violence, or what Sadia Hartman called, quote, the racial calculus and political arithmetic that were entrenched centuries ago, unquote. This calculus of racial capitalism is the result of traditional forms of racial, gendered, and nationalist exploitation becoming overlaid with, developed and exacerbated by, a mediological semiotic layer that signifies bodies and inscribes upon them the terms of the conditions by which they may be systemically treated, making them systemically legible and functionalizable accordingly. It is, in brief, the treatment of people and peoples as writing surfaces, as commodities, as quantities, and thus today, as information. It is the violent overdetermination and delimitation of people's life potentials. Like the mortgage industry's securitization of home loans that was a precursor to their stripping and recombination in order to sell them as derivatives, composing and recombining social bodies and writing contracts on their futures that can be sold on the financial markets is what's going on today. Such structural statistical delimitations of people's potentials, really just an abstract way of describing sovereignty, property, and advertising in the same terms, must be understood as the way in which hegemonic capital formations, namely banks and sovereign states, securitize populations in order that they can write options on their futures. These inscriptions on bodies and the contracting for their potential, based upon the amalgamation of data referring to their social similarities and social difference, is no mere metaphor, but the basis for sovereign debt, media conglomerates, and synthetic finance. So, toxic information. The coding of bodies and treating of them as read-write surfaces and treating of them as read-write media of representation that ordains a socio-semiotics evaluation and violation, using historically worked-up categories such as race, gender, nationality, religion, sexuality, brings us to the ideas of encoding and information. Information, I would argue, is not an ontological condition. It has not always existed. But it is rather a historical category of functionalization that emerges directly out of the organizing power of the value form, and specifically from the relation known as price. Price was the result of a background calculus aiming to adequate the value of money with the value of abstract universal labor time inherent in any other commodity. It was, in other words, a pre-informatic form that through a long developmental history of mathematics, financial instruments, and science, gave rise to the generalization of informatics such that one could put a price on absolutely anything, from liking a photograph to particle accelerators. Whether it's the primitive measuring of kilograms of wool for coats, as we read about in Marx, or the microsecond glances of eye-tracking software, metrics are a means to price. Information emerges as the systems language for capital. Metrics and the execution of programs based upon them allow for the writing of derivatives. In fact, in light of synthetic finance, where derivatives emerge to undercut the seeming ontology of the quote-unquote real economy, price itself can retrospectively be understood as itself a derivative, a contractual hedge against the generalized volatility of abstract universal labor time, which is to say, the volatility of value itself. Price is an option to buy a thing X at price Y. In other words, post the rise of information, it's derivatives all the way down. The rise of information must therefore be grasped as a historical elaboration and formalization of the mechanisms of price, an extension of its incipient derivative logic into the tissue of all, capital A. This implies that like money, a real abstraction that valorizes price by means of a transaction, often without the necessity of formal calculation. Information is also a real abstraction. It is what can be posited and detected when the social totality has achieved a certain level of material complexity, in which the occasions for evaluation and valuation on the surface of a social continuum have multiplied exponentially beyond the number of distributed instances of co-evaluation characteristic of the early modern period. It should be obvious that this complexity that gives rise to information and rigorously proposes a tighter binding together of any events whatever is sociopolitical all the way down. Therefore, information, like money, is at once a social relation and a medium. Information is, in short, the medium of computational racial capitalism, its digital armature. Information is what I call cosmically distributed alienation, is bound to information-mediated perception, and implies the rise of information as an emergence of the preeminent representational system of computational capital. And as it is all pervasive, at least from the point of view of contemporary cognition, particularly as contemporary cognition is recursively integrated with computation for billions and billions of iterative cycles, information indicates not just the real subsumption of planetary life, but the real subsumption of the cosmos. Information is everywhere, or so it is said. The mere fact that capitalism, boiling life away on this little dot called planet Earth, could subsume not only the known universe, but all the unknown and unknowable ones necessitated by quantum mechanics and multiversal quantum splitting and everything else, at once dramatizes the extent of epistemic capture by computational racial capitalism and its tragic absurdity. We look out at the stars through the lens of slavery, and we perceive the universe through, that is, by means of, enslavement. That's what the full integration of informatics and perception implies. Slavery and colonial violence, the liquidation of peoples, quantity for quality, provides the indelible watermarks of all too human perception. It gives things their meaning. Math, science, finance, technology, literature, film, poetry, all the preconditions for informatic, prosthetic knowing unfold now in what Christina Sharp calls the wake, the afterlives of slavery, as do we. Information is not, as Bateson said, just a difference that makes a difference. It is a difference that makes a social difference. Here we have the connection between any binary opposition, whatever, and racial capitalism. And it is this notion that the entire system of media, finance, and information both sits atop, orchestrates, and functionalizes social difference that we must grasp very clearly, very clearly, for any political theory that might avoid simply being fodder for another round of capitalist extraction. Without a strategy adequate to informatics and financial capture, politics is threatened to become merely a subroutine of capitalism, as indeed, for the most part, it has. To be worthwhile, theory must make a difference and a social difference, but not just any kind of difference. The difference cannot accrue to capital. Theory must work against the dominant codes and against informatic capture that works to co-opt planning and liberation. How then to forego the fourth wall for a brief moment? Is it possible, although I can't see any of you very well, but I'm going to try to forego the fourth wall because I wrote it down. How then to forego that fourth wall, which I just alluded to? Is it possible to keep what I'm saying here from falling back into another capitalist production scheme, from simply being a garden variety derivative that I am writing and inviting you to bet on with me in order that you, individually in your work or however, might get a little more of the upside of racial capitalism? This would be the moment to take a dramatic sip of wine from the glass that I wish I had. For this line of questioning, proposing a thinking beyond capital has, time and again, proven to be an impossible task. Althusser posited an outside to ideology after demonstrating definitively that ideology has no outside. Matteo Pasquinelli more recently put it thus: how do you think a form of capital that is already thinking you? Or, to set an even higher bar, How do you outthink a form of capital that is already thinking you? So this is where I try to get positive. I'll say something about new economic spaces and also the Economic Space Agency as I go, and maybe we can talk about that more afterwards. But as I'm sure you're aware, and I'm sure you're actually working on, people are looking for escapes. People are taking seriously what Francois last night called the long road to freedom. And I think that's something we continue to try to make possible. Then I'll try to describe one strategy. New economic spaces. What if it were possible to reverse the hegemonic value extraction plaguing expression? What if it were possible that every time one made art, had a communitarian thought, wrote poetry, grew vegetables, organized, fought for social justice, played music, or engaged in study, the world media system did not convert the qualities of that activity into quantitative information that could be extracted and captured as alienated value for cartel shareholders, their banks, and police states? What if every aspect of your expression was not submitted to capitalist financialization, such that in the last instance, your words and your very metabolism were used to exacerbate inequality no matter what you said or did? This escape from toxic media, toxic finance, and toxic information is what social movements, autonomous inclinations, poetry again, and collective struggles against injustice and for liberation are up against. The capture and evisceration of our expression by capitalist media, by computational racial capitalism. What I am suggesting here, drawing on both my own analysis of computational capitalism and my recent involvement with the Economic Space Agency, EXA, members of whom are in the house here, is the possibility and indeed the necessity of creating new economic spaces, of making a political and intellectual wager on the possibility of radical finance and anti-capitalist economic sustainability. It is not easy for me to say something positive about finance, but the slave, though bound in irredeemable violence by the hold, the plantation, and objectification, is not one with these forms of violence. The survival of the slave is an overcoming, as is the struggle for liberation and for life. So too is the native, more than the colonial regime may allow, just as the worker is more than a trained gorilla or cog. More prosaically, economic aspirations that arise out of conditions of violence are not necessarily one with them. This cleavage between aspiration and exploitation implies a split between the role of finance as a mathematical system of adequation among socially differentiated entities and capital as an apartheid system of hierarchical value extraction that thrives by means of dispossession and genocide. Where the break may be located and how it is ramified is an open question, but a program for the reverse subsumption of expressivity would involve a decolonization of media, of finance, of information, and of money, and the democratization of financial tools. In particular, the instruments of monetary issuance, debt, credit, and forms of synthetic finance, known as derivatives, can no longer be monopolized by banks, states, cartels, and their military-industrial, carceral, genocidal systems. Nor can the computational abstraction of information, the scraping of our data and metadata, be given over to fixed capital. If financial armatures have been inexorably wedded to expressive media, then short of destroying those armatures in Luddite fashion, we, who may think in terms of revolution, consult a necessity to reconfigure the mechanisms of aggregation, distribution, and account such that value abstraction doesn't always send value to capital. What if, in short, capital and capitalists no longer had a monopoly on the writing, publishing, and execution of derivatives? What if we broke capital's monopoly on securing the financial execution of the expressive act made algorithm that financially and juridically underpins derivative finance and conditions what I am calling derivative living? Capitalism can no longer be allowed to be the only and ultimate beneficiary from volatility or the only entity with options. Ironically, perhaps, the anti-essentialist theory of value implicitly expressed by the series of economic measures known as the Nixon shock that rejected Bretton Woods and the IMF's binding of international currencies to the gold standard and marked its abandonment broke up an aspect of the monotonic conception of value authorized by one period of global capital. It understood, the Nixon shock understood, that in the world of commodities, values were relative to one another, just as Marx had explained, and did not always need to be referred back to gold. Gold was rendered once again one commodity among others, and value was not essential to it, but rather relational. Thus, value need not be expressed in the terms of the golden monologue, but was seen as an expression of social relations, which among Marxists are most often understood as relations of production tied to abstract universal labor time, but in post-Bretton Woods policy were specifically recast in terms of sovereign states and more explicitly in terms of national power, including and especially military power and its derivative political power. Rather than the security of the voice of gold, value was now to be underwritten or securitized by the apparent stability of the nation state and the socio-semiotics of the state's commitment to its national currency. It was declared by fiat and tied to national expression. Value was made performative. With the cryptocurrency explosion that everybody knows about, the world is going through another phase shift on par with the Nixon shock. But this phase shift, which begins to outmode so-called fiat currencies, will not, in keeping with its mode of emergence, be declared by fiat, nor will it have to be. It is rather a matter of practice, of socio-computational practice, a new order of performance tied to new instruments of attentional calculation. A different kind of social contract. It follows from the half trillion dollar perception, the current market cap of all cryptocurrencies combined, that the distributed computing platforms can securitize an increasing quantity of social relations better than can national platforms. At any rate, that's the wager. But by better, I detect here a modality of organizing social expression much more in sync with the democratic, liberatory, geopolitical aspirations of the general intellect, the fugitive, the refugee, and all who would escape from the colonialism of white supremacist, cis, hetero, patriarchal capitalism and its myriad discontents. Not everyone, or even that many people, are thinking about crypto that way. But no one will deny that we are currently in a moment of national international dysfunction and collapse, a moment of intense volatility that has spread well beyond the well-policed Western comfort zone that also polices the confines of the colonial peripheries in the global South. States, even if not financially bankrupt, are ethically bankrupt. I mean, I guess they have been for a long time, but even more so, if they are to be measured by the minimum accounting requirement for ethics, acting in accord with your stated values, whatever they might be. Macro-politically, states confront the same semantic collapse that most of us do micro-politically. Our words are devalued, hollowed out, repurposed, instrumentalized, and eviscerated in accord with financial programs not necessarily of our own writing. The soul has been put to work, as Tiziana Terranova reminds us in Red Stack Attack by invoking Franco Berardi's great title, and the soul has been rendered proletarian. At every level, from individual subject to subject nation, the old semiotic is dead, and even critique is dead, as so many panels have remarked. Language has been disaggregated from its reference and reaggregated in accord with new financialized reality that programmatically defies comprehension. This reality defies representation such that fake news has become more real than the real itself. Languages, like images, are functionalized. Financialized media in its current determinations constitutes a war on the senses, a forced labor camp, a performance engine, a command performance engine for value aggregators. In a diverse world everywhere facing the immiseration of souls, the most widely shared political question of our time may well be how to retake expressivity to reverse its subsumption by capital. Like it or not, this question, with all of its cultural complexity, implies another: how to wrest finance from the clutches of racial capitalism. Wielding the contemporary potentials of decentralized, trustless computing that we might somewhat inaccurately, if conveniently, shorthand here as blockchain, activist organizations, artist collectives, and social movements might start to issue their own currencies and create their own programmable economies that sustain their activities in ways that they themselves decide, by creating structures that function in accord with their own values. What this means very simply is that groups of like-minded people engaged in sociocultural production and the redesign of social architectures and social participation could set the terms of their own valuation and actively recalibrate the terms of the economy in which they co-create the world. Just as a collective of filmmakers might set out to make a film, or a group of activists plan a media strategy that includes the visibility of protest, organizations could plan an economy in which their expressivity finances their continuation. This could be thought of as qualitative finance, the collective designing of sustainable social architectures with an emphasis on the quality sought by communitarian practices. Such a possibility suggests that any organization or constellation of actors could issue equity in their social, cultural, and aesthetic projects with the ease and incredible deftness of thought of posting on social media. It would be to say to the proprietary state, in the words of an ex-anthem, fuck basic income, we want basic equity. It is difficult, but not impossible to imagine, as indeed Brian Massumi and Aaron Manning, along with the folks at SenseLab have, that constellations of radical anarcho-communist agents might achieve such equity holdings in their projects without internally colonizing their own activity by and for the value form. This call for self-issued programmable money, what elsewhere I identify as a fourth determination of money, is a dangerous game, no doubt. But as phrases like post-Fordism, cognitive capitalism, and attention economy indicate, it is one that is already being played. And most of the tools still belong to those who, objectively speaking, are our enemies. Seizing the means of production, whether understood now as computational or cognitive infrastructure, requires something half forgotten over the past 50 years of left struggle, an economic plan. Currently, value abstraction, either is mediated by money at work through, for example, the wage, that's quantity for quality, or by information on social media through, for example, likes, is one with value extraction. That is, abstraction and extraction are the same act. Through tools that allow for everyday people to program their own economies and create their own economic spaces, it may be possible, and this is the wager of this paper, uncomfortable, but still the wager, it may be possible to have value abstraction without value extraction, such that qualitative projects, our socio-subjective lifetimes, will not be vitiated by the abstraction process, but rather will become interoperative with larger economies in ways that sustain those very qualities. Such endeavors of monetary self-issuance, bound to the expressive vitality of new economic spaces, would create an informatic trace of the sociality of a constellation of radical agents. This trace would archive its endeavors and evolve as its network of communicative activities evolved, effectively materializing its expression in a relatively inalienable mode. Actors, participants, writers, and readers could all share stakes in the project. The inscription and archivization of the attentional erotic bonds that combine to imagine communities and is today extracted by centralized proprietary platforms in an exponential intensification of alienation could be repurposed with a set of democratic controls such that producers of sociality directly participate in the product and its governance. The product in such cases is not just a reified object, but a whole process of social formation, a way of life. Concretely, a constellation's expressive activities, a performance-production relation partially broken away, broken away from the command-control virtuosity imposed by ambient capitalism, would generate its local currency that would then be interoperable with other economic spaces and could also provide liquidity for that constellation with participation or buy-in from supporters. They would create engines for organizing sweat and other resources into sustainable modes of sociality. Were it possible to configure such convivial spaces of sustainable activity, then without a doubt, it would be desirable for most of us, those of us who are not in the majority of our constitutions, direct beneficiaries of the world financial system of computational racial capitalism, to move our practices into such cooperative forms. It becomes possible to imagine not just one co-op capable of creating its own programmable economy, operating under the directives of its own emergent becoming, but a platform of cooperatives, of people working in non-extractive economies who also decide that they want to interact with one another on the basis of shared values robustly conceived. By linking expressivity in politics directly to self-authored economic spaces, justice groups may create hedges against the dominant financial system, effectively authoring derivatives that say, come risk with us. In authoring their own derivatives, liberationists may write the terms of their economies and social architectures, rather than have these terms written on their bodies, spaces and futures by banks and sovereign states. The conviviality of such a system of democratically authored movements that were financially sustained by retaining their own value and values would continually draw participants such that the capitalist economy might be slowly hollowed out and implode. though we must add, not without a fight. This is the fight that many of us, in our own ways, have taken up for a long time, the fight for a non-exploitative, non-discriminatory world and for non-extractive economies. Perhaps it is time to up our game on emancipation. Many of us work for change and we work hard. For change to be lasting, that is, if we want to reverse this assumption of our poetico-political expressivity and to prevent our sensuous labor, our communitarian aspiration, our care, and what is in short our work from being immediately monetized by the lords of things as they are in the next cycle of capital, then radical politics needs to draw upon both its cultural repositories created from centuries of hard-won struggle and upon new monetary strategies, even if the end game is the abolition of private property and of money itself. A path forward for reparative justice and liberation struggles might be a supranational platform communism. The reverse assumption of politics and expressivity requires democratic economic platforms capable of hollowing out capital from within. New strategies of artful, solidary living can be experimented with, designed and tuned on a decentralized, massively distributed, cryptographically incorruptible platform, itself collectively owned by those who participate in building it with their vital sociality. Granular socioeconomic programming is already underway. We know that. It must be democratically authored if it is not to be fascistic. If in Walter Benjamin's day, fascism forecloses democracy by aestheticizing politics and communism responds by politicizing art, today we note that fractal fascism extends that foreclosure at a planetary scale by means of the computational financialization of expression, the programming of affect, and the scraping of metadata. Splitting finance from capital, communism must respond through the radical decentralization and democratization of the reigning economies of expressive finance. Thank you.
John, thanks for this incredible talk, and welcome to this decompression room here. Now we take it. Before we offer you a glass of wine, you have to explain a few things to us. I would like to start, if you don't mind, from very concrete examples of proposals that are coming out from your program. I like this idea of computational capital because it's one of the few ideas that is able to put Marxian term, the abstract and the concrete together, the algorithm and the slave. But it would be nice to start from the concrete, from the base, if you can give an example of this project, of the Economic Space Agency, or any idea of this kind of crypto-communism that you have in mind, that because you, in a brilliant way, propose the fact that maybe it's time to untangle this cryptocurrency blockchain technologies from a kind of dangerous terrain alliance with the financial capital, and maybe indeed to reverse engineering towards another direction and maybe overlap them with the conflict, the social struggles we are engaged with. But John, if you can.
Zasan, okay. Thanks, Matteo. I think I'm going to respond to that first by saying something about what the wager is here, and also about my own sense of my very limited role in this project. I mean, in laying out a way forward or trying to, I don't think that there's any single author here. I mean, I think the urgency of inventing new economic forms is something that is a social problem and a social situation which will have many, many authors who have their own needs. And there are members of EXA in the audience who may want to speak a little bit and say something more concrete about EXA in a moment. But what I want to say is that part of the inspiration for this article is from something that Trotsky said in thinking about the transition to communism, which was that one couldn't really do it without metrics. That And Hayek also understood this about the market, that the computational processing of information in the market would outpace any organization of economies by committee, right? And so at this point, with crypto and the movement towards the democratization of financial instruments, it's possible to transform those set of controls of information and value outside of the parameters of banks and states. So let me just leave it at that for a moment. And then if people want to say concrete things, I'll let them.
Just to continue maybe on this terrain of political programs and subjectivities, in the way I perceive the recent Bitcoin hype and the saving bubble, I noticed a kind of, you know, regeneration of the dot-com bubble and indeed a regeneration of the same class, of the same generation of web developer, coder, that somehow continue a kind of self-entrepreneurial dream after a kind of, very dramatic collapse of the dream of the 90s. How do you see, how do you indeed frame your project within the context of a hype, bubble, risk also for the same technology, the same financial techniques that you advocate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bitcoin was kind of an amazing achievement, in as much as it was able to abstract financial issuance and move it from the state platform. And as much as I think it's in some ways overrated, in other ways underrated in terms of what kind of intellectual and social break it creates. But it is, in many ways, it's a re-engineering of the social contract. Because of the way in which you get computers to agree on a leader which will decide what transactions are real, and then everybody else follows along through the legitimation process assured by the cryptographic hash. My comment about Bitcoin in response to your question is that this hash, right, which is the creation of a set of transactions that then go into the blockchain as a part of the permanent record, is actually a hash of social relations. But the encryption is minimal. It's all you have is that who transacted what coin, and there's no robustness to it. With the development of smart contracts and new computing languages, a kind of robust abstraction process which has many more variables and a much larger archive becomes possible.
That's a very fascinating description that maybe we should unpack. I don't know if maybe we follow now some questions coming from the audience, if I received the okay from the curators of the festival. I received the okay. So I would like to open for questions and response from the audience, but I need help because we don't see you. We are a bit blinded by the light. Is there any question? John, is anybody? Would you like to raise a question? I see. Okay. Kurt, yes. Martin, please.
Well, congratulations. Maybe you could take us back a little bit earlier and to make the bridge between your earlier work and what you do now, and say something about, let's say, the money turn or the monetary turn that you went through yourself. Because, okay, you said there is the, you know, democratization now of democratic tools, and we have this enormous open playing field where a lot of people, also present here, feel that we can and we should contribute to something that is very fundamental. We go right into the heart of the beast, right? This is what we do, because we're going to at least attempt to redefine money. And as you say, as social relationships, knowing the past. And that bridge, because you built the bridge also, right? We talked about racism, slavery, and then we take that knowledge, let's say that common collective knowledge, and we take that into the rooms where we collectively try to design something else. But at what point, you know, you yourself, thought, okay, I have to get involved in this.
Well, I'll try to answer that. My early work on the attention economy actually came out of an interest in revolutionary cinema, where I was looking at people fighting for their own liberation in Latin America, Soviet Union, other places, trying to create images in order to wage war against colonial extraction, effectively, or capitalist extraction. And the insight for me there in the cinematic mode of production was that the visual was a non-colonized space or an incompletely colonized space and opened up a realm of freedom, and that people quickly were entering into this realm of freedom because effectively they were checkmated in other places. And you needed a visual technology and a set of images to catalyze revolution, right? And of course, you know, people like Solanas and Giottino, the Third Cinema Manifesto, saw mass movements as the basis for third cinema practice, which was not about making perfect films. It was actually about creating catalysts for social change, and there was a dialectical relationship there. But this sort of emergence of the space of the visual as a realm of possible freedom, for, you know, if activism organized it, opened for a moment and then closed very quickly. I mean, if you think, they also said Hollywood was more effective than napalm, right? So you had sort of, as the visual opened up, you also had the shutting down and the reorganization of the imaginary through a dominant kind of encoding, which then structured fantasy and basically marked populations and imprinted communitarian aspirations of a certain kind, which were, I'm speaking very generally, but which were in accord with global hegemony as exercised by the United States and the West. But this was what I began to realize when I started thinking about computation and informatics, was that this was already, and I argued this in the cinematic mode of production, that there was this cultural substrate was being financialized effectively, that these were not just ways of manipulating people at an ideological level, it was actually a calculus of valuation which had many, many levels and many cycles in its process. So maybe in the first cycle it was pleasure to go to the movies, but later there were the Hollywood coffers and there was the military industrial complex, the state, and all these sort of layers which were built on top of these experiences on the screen. So I was already thinking about cinema as a financial medium, I mean very specifically, that's why the book is called The Cinematic Mode of Production. And so when I read the Bitcoin paper, Satoshi Nakamoto's paper in, I guess, 2011, and I saw that he had sort of decoded a way of creating a monetary platform that was secure and decentralized, I realized that this was an opening up of the space of finance, which had been so totally shut down and colonized that many of us hadn't imagined that there was a possibility within that space. And so we're all, you know, culture workers. Right? I mean, we're organizers and activists, but we've given up on financial planning. I feel like the crypto space is being very quickly shut down, and that there's sort of like a window here of a couple of years maybe, and until the conversation is going to change, unless, you know, we're very, very successful. But that the crypto space is also being closed down quickly, and the banks are getting involved. You agree? And that there's, as you say, we have to sort of like enter into this. And for me, sort of like, you know, intellectually and politically, this is a huge risk. I'm actually not entirely comfortable giving the paper that I just gave, because I've really stared into this abyss. And I feel you. And I've stared into this abyss and looked down and said, do I really mean this seriously? Are we really going to take digitality this far and sort of make even more granular this process of encryption? Because, you know, are we just doing the work of another cycle of capitalism that more deeply colonizes the psyche and language? Or are there spaces to open up if you can distribute and democratize computational process and recognize financialization can remove from capital accumulation? Are there spaces in which activists can actually take very seriously? And this paper for me is kind of a test. I actually want feedback. I want to, like, you know, have these ideas talked about. I want people to know more about EXA, maybe get involved with the EXA project. It's a very interesting project. And just, you know, experiment. Because I feel like transmediality, one of the cool things about it, at least maybe this is wrong, but, you know, it's like, this isn't really an academic conference. I mean, people are fucking smart. But, you know, it's like, people are makers here. People are doers. And that's, to me, a really exciting place to be.
Thank you. We have another question here, please. Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. What?
Can you say your name?
Marcel.
Sorry, Marcel.
It doesn't matter. So, I would say formalization is hard, and I was really impressed as you were chaining, as you were adding sentence after sentence in your lecture. It was like a kind of like a metaphorically like a good blockchain, until it actually got into the blockchain. And I'm very envious for that, because I feel that my English will never be there. You know, my English will never kind of reach that kind of level of formalization, because formalization is hard. But formalization is also fetishized. And especially at the moment when you mention the smart contracts, and then when you kind of put it in relation to the social social relations, I get very, very skeptical, because if you ever did any kind of contracts in between people, being yourself involved or being in any kind of social situation, you would know that formalization doesn't really help, because there is no way how you can really kind of formalize the way how we are fucked up, how we are messy, how we don't understand what we are doing, how we don't understand how what others are thinking, what we are doing, or what we know about what they are doing, or what they know about what we know, what they know, you know. So it goes very far away. And at the same time, having something in any kind of a timeline where you cannot get back and renegotiate and struggle is, in my opinion, much politically much more dangerous than anything we had so far. And I think that the politics are possible today because we didn't reach certain level of formalization. And if we get there, then we are fucked, because then some of the things are very, very, very grounded down into something where we hardly can negotiate, and that's mathematics. And then I'm sure that you can make a quite good critique of the mathematics and the formalization, and I would like if you can get back to what you were saying with your promises about these blockchains, because that's where I become very skeptical. That's the one thing. There is another one which is very short. And that's about the when we get into the technology. It usually works when we have some need. And especially if you are collective or social, then it's very hard to get there, and then that we really need technology. And I think that when it comes to the currencies, it's really about the production. And our production, which comes from the solidarity, international, whatever, beyond any nation state, it's very weak. And then having something like a currency before we actually got into the production of value or whatever, I think that it's kind of like a... It's really like almost the definition of a fetish. Thank you.
And thanks, Marcel. I use the term blockchain as a shorthand, and the idea that contracts are irreversible is one notion. It doesn't necessarily have to be the notion that if you really open this up and imagine that kinds of encoding which are not fully possible today might become possible, then you could build in the sort of more flexibility, more negotiation than blockchain seems to afford. I realize that's not going to fully quench your discomfort with what I said, but I think that's a possibility. Also, I mean, I'm not making any promises. I just want to be clear about that. There's no promises in what I'm saying. This is a challenge. It's a challenge that I'm feeling, that I'm experiencing in my own work. I feel like it's an interesting road to move down for a while. And I think that because I am so aware of the way in which cultural practice and other kinds of solidarity movements are continuously colonized. I mean, as somebody who's been in the academy for a long time and worked both inside and outside the academy politically, there's the sort of post-Fordism of not only my practice, but everyone's practice in one way or another, the absorption of that by financial systems, which we don't have any control of, I think is a challenge that many of us are facing. And the kind of objection we feel in relationship to our own practice and our own recognition, our own community, I think that's also something that's fairly widely shared. I mean, especially in the United States, I'm less familiar with the European scene. So those are not, strong reposts to your discomfort, but I just want to make clear that blockchain is only one version of the way in which one could base smart contracts or other ways of creating computational relations, which are, I think, could be more nuanced and more subtle and more. And that's actually what I'm thinking about when I say qualitative finance. So there's that, and then there's like this no promises business. I want to be really clear about that. I'm not promising anything. I don't know if this is going to work. It's just I think it's an opening that many of us should take seriously.
Yeah. I was thinking if you heard about like the what some people are already calling like the great graphic card shortage of 2018. It's like this weird thing that like basically like graphic cards. Some people recently realized that like graphic cards used to be something like basically only relevant to like 3D graphic nerds and video and gamers. So now like they realize that they are a great way to do like cryptocurrency mining. And so they started to get sold out, and like models of like professional graphic cards that used to go on the market for like 500 euros, now they are being resold on Amazon and eBay for over 1,000 euros and $1,000. And now like ADM is literally having to like change their production lines in order to, and this has all been caused by like cryptocurrencies, but it's definitely going into the like mainstream tech market and like putting back our like attention, I think, to the idea that like whatever you want to do with cryptocurrency, you have to like do mining for even not Bitcoin, but for other like more egalitarian potentially forms of cryptocurrency. You have to do mining, which is based on like hardware distribution, which is obviously going to be like more affordable in the first world countries. And then you also need like people with like computer engineering backgrounds, which fits back on like educational divide, which of course like richer people have a way larger access to education right now, and like people in the tech industry have specific kind of backgrounds. I wonder like how your more abstract theory fits back into this practicality.
Thanks. I hear all those challenges, and you know, aside from the environmental challenge of crypto mining, which is a huge energy consumer and polluter. But I think of it kind of like prison abolition. In a sense that if you think about what abolition feminism teaches us about the carceral system, you don't just like get rid of the prisons and you're done, right? It actually is a long process of reimagining all social relations. And what I'm getting at here is a way of consolidating organizations in a self-sustaining way, which could then begin to expand social justice movements and fund them in ways of their own design. So, for example, you can probably tell from what I'm saying already that I'm not a programmer, and my understanding of that is minimal. So I'm not going to try to pretend anything here, but there is something that X has been working with, is just called object capability programming. And Mark S. Miller, who's one of the founders of the smart contract with Nick Szabo, is a designer of this language. And if you could run a currency on object capabilities language, then mining wouldn't need to be required in order to secure the system and secure validation. So there are possible ways out of these problems, but there's no one-size-fits-all solution.
Please. Hi, you asked for comments, so I apologize in advance. Thank you very much for that talk. It's very interesting, but I do have a question about your methodology to arrive at the point of cryptocurrency. And I think the part of the confusion, and correct me here if I'm wrong, but it seemed as if the presentation was just a diversity ad for Bitcoin. I know that wasn't your intention, but the reason why I say that is actually, I mean, if you're saying something, and we do have an emerging amount of discourse that's positioning even the foundation of capital is being predicated on the violence of the black body, and if we converge that with enumerative logics that, of course, pre-existed any sort of machine learning or AI, which again was predicated on gendered and racialized bodies. And what we're articulating now is the convergence of those two technologies to then propose that another technology that also depends on protocols to control standardization and other modes of power can then cause a breach of liberation, but then in that breach, you excluded again the black body. So I'm curious about your entry point, using blackness as an entry point, only to sort of disrupt blackness right at the end in this idea that for me, it sits uncomfortably with me, because although cryptocurrency may articulate a mode of speculation for new networks of financialization and capital, we do know explicitly that the technologies that are actually at the foundation of this technology are the same systems and logics of control and enumeration that were already predicated on violence against bodies of difference. And I'm basically asking the question in the form of an ethical issue to sort of avoid this mirroring of Silicon Valley where we see speculation and we see difference and we see possibility in the new idea of newly emerged technologies. And then if an ethical issue arises, then we'll deal with that retrospectively. Because as we know of Bitcoin right now, I mean, it may decentralize modes of financialization, but I don't think that we should conflate that decentralization with deflating power, because the power is just shifting into different modes. There are people getting rich off of this, and those people will enact the violences, so on and so forth. And I'm curious about your thoughts of a space living simultaneously where those that actually operate power through financialization do it in the same space that also those forms of resistance are trying to enact resistance the same against the same power. And then also the sort of the final question, and I'm hoping I misunderstood you here, is if you're predicating this mode of resistance on the black body, then where does the black body enter into cryptocurrency besides being a client at an NGO?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that question and comment. When I was, maybe I haven't given enough examples of the kinds of design that I have in mind, but certainly it's not my intention or even my sense of what I'm doing that I'm leaving blackness or politics of decolonization and anti-racism out of my talk and out of my set of concerns. I mean, when I think about the possibilities of currency issuance by people who have been dispossessed or people who have faced situations of oppression, my imagination is that the kinds of solidarity that people use for survival, if you think about Black Lives Matter, for example, or other activist organizations which work against local injustices in a city like Detroit, it might be possible for organizers to actually write a derivative through their issuance and through their expressive practice, which would sustain their activities through a kind of currency issuance. So if, for example, a group in a small city was able to issue a currency which gave them liquidity and allowed for development of a richer, self-sustaining social through the practice and through the expression, then that expression could intensify and actually become more powerful against the hegemonic form. So that's why I say reverse assumption. I mean, I feel like anything we say or anything we do, any money that we make, anytime we get a paycheck, all of that is built on racial capitalism and the history of colonization. There's no escaping that for any of us. And I'm trying to answer your call, and you're calling me out, that I haven't attended to it enough in my presentation in terms of what I'm suggesting. But the gesture that I felt like I was making is one in which people who have been structurally and historically disenfranchised might take back a set of financial controls. But that's why I say the window is very small, and I'm very aware that what's going on with Bitcoin and crypto, and that some people are getting rich, and they're going to be the same kind of people who are running Silicon Valley. That's not what I'm here making an advertisement for. I mean, at least that's not what I think I'm doing. You may think otherwise. But what I think I'm doing is I'm saying that there's a possibility in this for everyday people to take over some of the financial tools. People use smartphones. I mean, 10 years ago, nobody thought anyone had smartphones. Now a lot of people have smartphones, not everybody. But increasingly, more and more people have access to computation and use computation in relationship to their you know, work all over the planet at almost every class, right? So if you could use these affordances in order to create new economies, and you can tune those economies according to your needs, then you're in a different situation than you are right now.
Are there more questions? Another question over there. We have 10 minutes left, but I guess it's nicely beautiful.
Hi. Just a quick question, I guess more kind of generic. You mentioned at some point that it's like cycles, open cycles, and you never know if the capital will still be hegemonic and take over. My question is, would you like to elaborate on that? And how do you know that any intellectual endeavor you're into is actually going to be outside the capital and outthink the capital, and kind of, how do you measure, how do you know if, that's something outside or it's still in or something capital will colonize again? Thank you.
I think that's a really good question. I mean, obviously, one of the points of my talk was to suggest that expression itself is increasingly financialized, such that it becomes very difficult to utter anything, even in the form of seemingly radical critique, without also having a careerist move in mind, without also sort of trying to raise your social capital and legitimate yourself in a community which will then valorize your activity and give you more economic power socially. So the question about what is the outside of capital, I think, is really the difficult one and the most challenging one. But we do know that within the space of capitalism, the global space of capitalism, there is radical and profound inequality. And we also know that certain people exercise a tremendous amount of power over other people based upon their capacity to position themselves in a system of extraction. What I'm suggesting with my notion of platform cooperativism and platform communism is that those terms can be reconfigured such that community-based activities can actually retain more of the value that they produce themselves. That value extraction doesn't necessarily follow in the process of abstraction, which it does with the wage and what it does with centralized platforms like Facebook and Google, which as soon as they turn whatever gesture you make into information, they can monetize it in one cycle or another. The more that people can control their own processes of abstraction and expressivity, the more likely it is that they can control their own values and structure their own values. Like I said, no promises. This is just a proposal, something to think about.
More questions? I see somebody approaching the microphone. Yes.
Yeah, there's something really interesting in your talk that I wanted you to say a little bit more about, and that was, it was something that was moving away from the currency idea. In other words, the idea of having control of your own way of exchanging value, which is one of the things that people like about cryptocurrencies. But for me, that's not that interesting in the sense that versions of that have existed before. Things like LETs, local exchange trading, things where people set up their own version of a kind of trading system for jobs and work and so on in small communities. But the bit that interested me was the things you were saying about equity and the idea that actually what's interesting is taking over some of these financial ideas that have previously been used in capitalism and redeploying them. And equity as a way of sharing risk is something you can't do. So there are these local communities that have set up exchange trading where you trade babysitting for something else, building a shed or something. But that doesn't help people to plan for the future and share the risk and then share the value in the risk that they've taken, if you see what I mean. So what I was wondering is if you'd looked at any of the work there's an economist in the UK called Martin Wolf, who is he's kind of a free market World Bank person who then became a bit more Keynesian. He's not a communist by any means. But he's written a book about how the idea of equity, if it was spread much more widely and used much more widely through society, would help to make financial crisis less likely and this kind of thing. So I just wondered if you'd made that connection.
Yeah, I mean, equity is a term that I'm struggling with, quite frankly. On the one hand, it's a way of shorthanding a set of rights to social product, which are not ordinarily available to people who are in a position of simply having to reproduce their own lives. I also think that some of the microfinance stuff was highly problematic. I mean, I'm aware that sometimes people are issued papers and get equity on properties so that in the next cycle, gentrification or other kinds of extraction can take place while bringing people into the system. To me, the sort of kind of financial literacy and financial control becomes really clear, and the project of a anti-capitalist economy also seems to be a necessary component to this thinking, because if you sort of like just say equity and then let equity play out the way it does ordinarily, then you're in the same system of valuation and the universal value form, which is white and male and Western also at the same time. So again, this is a line of questioning and a line of inquiry and something that requires more thinking. But the very short version of the reason I called it equity was because it's about allowing people to have more access to the things they make.
Thanks, John. I was informed that was probably this the last question, and we are running out of time. Is there anybody else that wants to add something to this controversial terrain we are crossing, Pete? And
that's a short
the
one.
Dog.
As we have still like the last forms of real existing communism or kind of hybrid forms of communism, like in China, or you could say from the other side, Cuba, and their forms of networking or offline networks that were just presented at CCC. Maybe you could say something, you know, you heard about the social credit system in China. What about the real existing forms of platform communism and their potentials?
The real existing forms. Just before you sit down, what did you want me to talk about in China? Because I know a little bit about what's going on financially in China, but you're talking about the...
Since in China, basically the authoritarian regime is still like, at least on paper, a communist regime. And since they have a very, a larger top-down command structure to basically implement technological systems on a 5-year plan, for example, or 10-year plan. And with projects ahead like the Seidenstraße and larger technological projects, their power would be there to implement something along a longer planning perspective than it's possible basically from Silicon Valley, which are probably more like a, you know, like Bitcoin, like a speculative short-term bubbles. But it's not necessarily like what we imagine from a European post-Adorno perspective, like an enlightenment or post-enlightenment form of power. Maybe you could expand more into this kind of cynical possibilities of post-communist platform communism, you know what I mean?
Yeah, John, basically how you outthink China. Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are trying to do that right now. But I am familiar that what's going on with the Chinese monetary system and the moving of it onto smartphones and the digitization of it and computationalization of it is that effectively through centralization, anyone's money could be turned off at any time if the Communist Party decided that was the thing to do, which to me. I mean, this is maybe an obvious lesson, but it makes the case for decentralized, secure computing. I mean, that's the whole point of having decentralization, is that there's no single authority who can exercise that kind of power over an individual's financial future. So in that sense, to me, that seems like a good thing, and also explains some of what happened in China with Bitcoin, maybe not everything. Actually existing communism, to me it's much more interesting to, not, it's much easier to talk about actually existing capitalism. Communism is something that's been built as a project over the last couple of centuries. It's in progress. I still think that there's an aspiration there. I don't think we need to stop talking about it. But I think that without a financial plan, as I was saying, without sort of like taking again economy seriously alongside culture, using contemporary computational possibility, it's not going to happen.
Thank you, John. I would like to find a way to wrap up this debate tonight. I would like to thank the organizers and the curators, Daphne, for inviting John. John, I hope you come back to Berlin also in the future. Thanks. Yeah, we're free. Follows instruction from there. Okay.